I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Horacio Castellanos Moya is a writer and a journalist. He has worked as an editor for magazines and newspapers in Mexico, in Guatemala, and in his home country. He has published over 11 novels, 5 short story collections, and 2 essay collections. They have been translated into 11 languages, and currently he teaches creative writing and media in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Iowa. With us from Cambridge, thank you, Rory, for coming. He's a senior lecturer in Latin American literature and culture at the University of Cambridge. He's also written a book called Spectres of Violence, La Violencia, and edits the Journal of Latin American Cultural Studies. Muchas gracias, Horacio. Muchas gracias, Rory. Please welcome our guest tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, thank you very much, Natalia. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thanks to the LRB and to the Salvadoran Embassy, and especially to Marta Dueñas for setting up this event. Thank you, of course, to Horacio for coming. It's a real great privilege to be here with you, Horacio, on your first visit to London. It's really great that you've made it down from the cold northern climes of Stockholm to London's sizzling tropical inferno. But it's a particular honour for me to be given an opportunity to talk with you today about your work, especially given how much I've enjoyed reading it over the last years. I think your work has been seminal in so many ways, not only in its reinvigoration of Central American narrative, a narrative which, sadly, for many of us who teach Latin American literary studies or cultural studies in the UK remains relatively unknown, I think. But I think it's especially interesting because of the unique perspective your work brings to understanding the changing landscape of post-dictatorial, post-Cold War Latin American culture, so-called, to experiences of political defeat, to the inversions and perversions of memory after the various civil wars, and to the current revisiting of old ideological pieties. I think it's unique in its sonority, in its sound, in your mastery of the first-person monologue, in its immersion into the murky passions and emotions that undergird everyday life in Central America and in Latin America, and in its pursuit of the percolation of politics or political passions through this murk, through paranoia, through anxiety, through terror. So as we agreed, rather than dwell at the general level so as not to run the risk of going straight into asking you to become a representative of El Salvador, as is often the case when a Latin American writer comes to Europe, I think we should proceed, as we agreed, to talk straight away about your novels. And I'd like to start asking you about insensatez, senselessness. So Senselessness was the first of your novels that I read, and no doubt the first of the novels that many of you, those here, will have read in translation. And it famously opens with the line, "I am not complete in the mind," said the sentence I highlighted in yellow marker pen as your narrator begins copying editing the 1,100-page report on human rights atrocities committed against the indigenous men and women in a country loosely identifiable as Guatemala. These words, the words of a Maya Quiche man who's seen his family butchered by the military, haunt the narrator and progressively augment his sense of paranoia, his sense that he too is not complete in the mind. And this, of course, as you remember, develops into a full-blown paranoid hallucination or trip. So the question, I'll get to the question, I promise. The question that occurred to me as I watched this very subtle interplay between individual and a collective perspective concerns the question of the text's direct or indirect revisiting of a testimonial writing tradition from Central America, and specifically the tradition of Rigoberta Menchú, whose testimonio of 1983 famously aligned her story with the story of all poor Guatemalans. So to what extent do you think senselessness, insensatez, builds on this testimonial tradition? To what extent do you critique that tradition or reorient its thematic and aesthetic concerns? Ahora sí le doy la palabra. Por fin. Muy paciente.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm very patient. Thank you, Rory. Thanks for being with me here. Thanks to the bookstore, to Natalia. Thanks to Elizabeth and the embassy, St. Francis Institute, Instituto Cervantes, that has supported me all around the world, I would say. Testimony, Central America, fiction. Let's say that both. Mm-hmm. You asked me if there is a kind of critique and a kind of reordering.
Reordering, yeah.
Yeah, both. Both because all these magnifying ideas about Central American testimony were important at this time. Mm-hmm. But testimony is an old general. I mean, Jenofonte wrote Analysis 500 years before Christ, and that's a testimony,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, but I think that there was a kind of trend by scholars, mainly in the U.S., saying that testimony was the new general.
Yeah, yeah.
Fiction was dead, the novel was dead, and the new literary phenomenon coming from not only Central America, because that came from Cuba in the beginning,
yeah,
right?
Biografía
of Cimarrón, Manuel, yeah, Barnett, and Canción de Raquel. Mm-hmm. And so of course, I could not agree with that idea of fiction is dead or novel is dead, and now Central America is going to be represented by testimony. I think that all political actors have the right to express them, their position, their experiences, their idea of the war, how they think that what happened to them has been important.
Yeah.
But that's not literature, in understanding of literature, right? That I respect that as kind of sociological testimony or anthropological. Mm. And so in that sense, it's a critique.
Yeah.
But in the other sense, it's a reordering. Why? Because I used it. Mm-hmm. Right? Of course, the book is based in a real terrible report, the report of how the armed forces of Guatemala kill thousands of indigenous population, right? I mean, 442 massacres, right? And you read the report, you get completely shocked. But when I read the report, and when I took the sentences from that report, that 6 years later, when I found that notebook, I decided, oh, this is a novel. I used them. I was shocked by the report, and I think that, but I said, I'm not going to use this. I'm not going to have my fiction book to go into the political debate in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the word Guatemala doesn't exist in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if in the first page I say Cachiquel Indians, you know that I'm talking about Guatemala,
yeah.
right? But
yeah.
there are these contradictory messages at the yeah. same time. So it's yeah. both. It's a critique of the idea that fiction doesn't exist and testimony is the new genre, or was, mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
because that collapsed afterwards. And I talk about this with one of the main brains on the back of that. Was a professor in Pittsburgh, and I mean he was reading Bolaño by the time.
Yeah.
So yeah. No, novel was there, right?
Yeah.
So, but
was this John Beverley?
Yeah.
yeah. Who makes this claim, doesn't he, that there is no literary quality at all? The claim was that this would bypass,
yeah.
would do away with literature.
Yeah.
It seems to me that your recovery. As literature, the very experience, the terror of reading.
Yeah, to bring it, I mean, the experience of, for me, the idea of literature is to you bring everything, all the collective experience to your personal experience, your personal emotions, your personal thoughts, and your personal way of facing life, right?
Yeah.
And so and that's how you create characters that are dealing with that. But I, as a fiction writer, I'm less interested in the historical truth of what is happening there than in the subjective truth that the character is facing, right?
That's right. I mean, and what I really found very suggestive was the words, "I'm not complete in the mind," along with these disjointed, fragmentary witness statements that your narrator reads, they capture the senselessness of violence. So violence is the way it exceeds rational, ideological motivations. But they're also, perhaps perversely, ripe, full of sense. And you try to capture that richness of sense, the psychic remainders, the traumatic resonances, and you make another book out of those excesses.
Yeah, because it's more than that. It's another culture, another civilization that is there, that the character that is the narrator doesn't get.
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And so, but he's not aware that he doesn't get it.
Yeah.
He's just getting the consequences of how this culture and this civilization was repressed or has been repressed for so many centuries.
Mm. So I was going to ask about his not getting it, because halfway through the book, he imagines that he's going to write another book. This is the story of two books, isn't it? The story of the Comisión de la Verdad, the Nunca Más, and then the story of his own book, which would speak from these excesses. And he starts to write it, but he can't finish it either.
Well,
and I wonder whether that was
he doesn't start. He just thinks that who is going to be interested in another book about killing Indians?
Yeah.
Right? That's what he says, right? I mean, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
So he's very cynical in that, right? But he has a good story to start the book. That is the story of this guy that was killed. He was the registrar of the town.
The
registrar of the town. And then, but that means that he's aware. This is a kind of paradoxical thing. He thinks that fiction is useless. That is a character of fiction.
Uh-huh.
There is talking about real facts.
Mm-hmm.
Think that those real facts could be used to write fiction, and he thinks that fiction is useless.
So he, in some senses, as a writer, has suffered the consequences of a public sphere that is saturated, in which there is only testimonio.
Yeah, but the book is written.
The book is written, I mean, I ask these questions because it seems that while being an intensely political book, like nearly all of your books, it doesn't, of course, take politics as a theme, does it? To the detriment of the literary. But consciously explores this processing of politics as psychic material, as literature. I know you've talked a lot about this before, But could you say something perhaps for this audience about this interplay between literature and politics as you imagine it?
I think that I mean, every writer is the product of his own or her own circumstances, right? Mm. So, and I am the product of my own circumstances. So that means that I grew up and I was raised in a place where politics was like everywhere, right? Mm. So my characters, at least this character, he doesn't care about politics.
No.
He doesn't care too much even about what he's reading. He's reading about the mass 440 massacres of indigenous, right?
Mm.
And he's not too much concerned. He's much more concerned about the, you know, his honorarium.
Yeah.
He's much more concerned about the girls that he's
about
going
the girls,
to get.
About going for a beer.
So, but then you see that on the back is this huge report, right? So I could say that in my books, that's the situation, that on the back, sometimes it's a huge report, or sometimes it's a very intense political situation, but it's, that's the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, that's the landscape. That's not the main issue. It's not about the power fighting between the political forces.
No.
You know, that is happening on the back. And the characters have their own passions, their own problems, their own, as you say, psychic crisis, emotional crisis, passions that are, literature is made of passion, right?
I think that's right. You say it's become background, it's become landscape.
Yeah.
It's become nature or second nature.
Second nature,
it's always there, like the heat.
Yeah.
Like that. You've elsewhere, this is related, you've described yourself as an auditory writer, as opposed to a visual one,
mm-hmm.
as someone who works with sound. I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about that distinction. So how does this interest in sound, in the voice, inform senselessness's exploration of this very fine line between psychosis, paranoia, and later poetry? There's a poetic dimension there, isn't there?
Yeah, he talks about the language that is like Cesar Vallejo poetry, because how the sense of time that the Maya culture has is not the sense of time that we have in the Western world, and how they try to adapt the Spanish language that is a Western language to their own concept of time, and so they change the adverb, they use the verb in a very different way. And so there is poetry there,
but
not poetry as a, because they have a will of creating poetry, it's just because they have so much pain that when they express the pain, the pain becomes, with these words, kind of very poetic language.
Mm.
I think that with the, this is very schematic about the ear and the eye, right?
Yeah.
And I think that we are, in that sense, in the same situation that with politics. That's not something that you decide. It's not your choice. It's, your talents are not your choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you hear, you hear. If you don't see, you don't see, right? So I don't know which parts of your education, besides your own senses, determine that kind of writer that you have become, in the sense that you work more with the language and with the rhythm and with the melody of the prose instead of working with the images, right? And I never decided. I that was a reflection that I had afterwards when I was asked because...
I
started to see that many writers that I like and I enjoy are these kind of writers.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a great writer, like a visual writer, a great writer, let's say Henry James, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it, but it's hard for me to read. You know what I mean?
I find it hard too. He's read them all. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about El Asco, Revulsion, which I think the voice is really prominent there, an extraordinary voice. I think this is probably your best known novel in Latin America, at least. Am I right, or am I?
I'm not so sure. Maybe so between Senselessness and
Elasco. So here we read, for those who haven't read it, the monologue of a very affluent Salvadoran, Edgardo Vega, who's returned from 18 years in exile in Canada, where he teaches art history, and he's come back to attend to his mother's funeral. There's always a deathliness, isn't there, in San Salvador? And then he meets up with this character who's tantalizingly referred to, who's called Moya. No resemblance, of course. And
he's not a character, he's just a big ear, right?
A big ear. And he pours scorn on the people, the politics, the customs of El Salvador, on the corruption and the violence of the left and of the right, on the nation's poverty, on its criminality, its lack of culture, on the objection of its privatized institutions, the contamination of its landscapes, and even on its music and food. Well, I'm reassured that you like pupusas.
Oh, yeah.
As a writer, yeah. The author likes pupusas.
Yeah.
But, so, I mean, Vega's rant is very disturbing, but it's not unfamiliar for those of you who, you know, those of us who've been to Latin America. You hear this quite a lot. But what I think really is quite surprising is that this really is a new eruption into, this is a novel voice in the contemporary Latin American novel. And that we talked a little bit about Fernando Vallejo, who I think is actually quite different. But with the exception of Vallejo, I haven't heard this kind of roar in literature for a long time. So related to this, the Guatemalan novelist and critic Arturo Arias sees the novel as the expression of a kind of post-war disillusionment. And for the Salvadoran critic and artist, and I think your friend, Beatriz Cortés, but we'll leave that for later, sees this as the novel as emblematic of an aesthetics of cynicism, also present elsewhere in Central American fiction. But my question is Edgardo Vega's hatred of the nation or of nationalism, is that really an expression of post-war disillusionment, or does it originate elsewhere?
You know, that book is a problem. But
it caused you a lot of problems too, didn't it?
Yeah, no, but the book is a problem. Let's forget my problems, but the book is a problem. Because you can hear so many different things about the book. I have a friend that is a very good reader. I mean, a very intelligent guy. He says that book is a kind of love song to El Salvador.
You only hate where you love.
So, but of course, the book represents historical period, and that's what you were talking about, in the sense that the book represents a kind of disillusionment with the new transition to democracy in El Salvador, and I think that. What happened is that transitions, there was a Chilean politician called Luis Mayra who used to say that transitions are gray.
Gray.
You know, revolutions are epic. You know? So when you have revolutions, you have epics around.
Yeah. Rupture.
But transitions are great. I mean, it's just happening. And so in the impression is that in this book, there is a kind of frustration, a kind of disenchantment with the idea that the country was going to change in a cultural way. You know? Because the country changed in a political way. Otherwise, the war had kept going, right? So the country had peace courts, you know, peace treaty.
Yep.
I mean,
there were hopes.
All the elements of democracy work in a way, bad or worse or better, but they are there. Independence of power, alternativity, you know, independence of electoral commission. All these elements are there.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that in the cultural way the country changes. So I think that that's what is in the book. Yeah. That's the main, like, and that's logical because you can push a political change, but to have cultural changes, you need generations.
Yeah.
You know, the timing of culture and the timing of politics are completely different. Yeah. And the timings of literature are even...
They follow different, yeah.
So, and I think that is that what you can find there. Yeah. Because when I left the country when I published that book, then I came back and people talked to me and said, you have to write the second part and whatever. And you know, there are these things that you didn't put in the book.
You
have to
you didn't criticize enough.
Yeah. And so I said, it's done, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So there's... It's interesting because there's disillusionment, and that's not the same as cynicism.
Oh no, nothing to do with cynicism.
Yeah.
No, I think that this theory of cynicism is a little bit like something not completely accurate. Mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. There is an article by a Spanish scholar that is in Texas, and he wrote about my books, and the title is the Question of Cynicism.
Yes, Alberto.
He says, Alberto, yeah. Yeah.
And he says, he critiques that.
Yeah,
idea.
He says
this doesn't work.
Yeah, because it's not the main point, right?
Yeah.
I think that the main point is that in my books, as in books and many in other writers of my generation, is a permanent critique on power.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right, and there has to be some kind of belief for there to be a critique of power.
Yeah,
and I think what he says there is one thing is to assume a cynical voice, and the other is to frame it. So I was going to ask about the most interesting character for me is Moya, who says nothing.
No, he's an ear.
Is that ear complicit, or is the silence of Moya, does that express dissent? Or is there a kind of gray zone again?
It's both.
Yeah.
It's both. Yeah, you know, it's like, first of all, let me explain to you a little bit how this book was written.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you understand a little bit about that. I mean, I started to write this book without knowing that I was writing a book.
Yeah.
I just started to imitate Thomas Bernhardt's style.
Yeah, uh-huh, already, yeah.
Because I had to go to a family reunion that I didn't want to go, and I felt like, ugh. And I was in Mexico, and
he's a pretty good companion for that kind of event, right?
And so... And I started to write this, how long could I write as Thomas Bernhardt, I said. Because I had been reading Thomas Bernhardt's book in these amazing translations that you have in Spanish. There is a, do you remember the name of the translator? Don Miguel Sáenz. He's this greatest translation that he has, right? Because I read Thomas Bernhardt in English and it's a little bit lost.
Yeah, yeah.
But in Spanish, it's like, you know.
Yeah. Has more punch.
Has more punch and this way of playing with language, taking language to the limit, right?
Yeah.
And so I said, how can I do that, right?
So it was an exercice de style.
That's how it started,
yeah.
And like, again, I even finished it. I wrote it like in 2 weeks, and I even finished it, and I put it in a drawer, and I didn't know that was a book.
Uh-huh.
Because for me, it was like a style exercise or whatever, right? Stylistic exercise. And so, but then I understood that the fact that I don't think doesn't mean that the book had ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so there were many ideas on the book that were representing my state of being of the time that was that, the state of being of defeat.
Mm-hmm.
Of being like, because I was out of El Salvador, the projects in which I had been for the transition were gone for me.
Yeah.
I didn't have a project for going back, and so what for? And
so this is the period you narrate in some ways in The Dream of My Return. And it was that kind of period.
Yeah, that after that period, the Dream of My Return is before.
Before 91, and then this is after 91.
Yeah, this book was written in 95.
Okay, yeah.
By the end of 95, was started the last day of 95.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps to change to talk about some other novels that people here will have read, I wanted to ask you about two novels which I think explore, again, the aftermath of the civil war in Salvador in very striking, unusual ways. And the first is Diablo en el Espejo, She Devil in the Mirror, and the second is El Arma en el Hombre, The Weapon in the Man, which I don't think has been translated. But so in El Arma en el Hombre, which I read first, because it's impossible to get these things in the right order on Amazon, you trace the dizzying twists and turns of fate and often startling changes of political allegiances that lead from civil war to criminal violence, and then from criminal violence to policing after the formal return of democracy. So we have this narrator, a former soldier called Robocop, for his sort of Ernst Junger-like transformation into a killing machine, who works first for a criminal network stealing cars, then with former militiamen engaged in murdering demobilized guerrilleros, seeking to enter politics. Then he works for a drug smuggling ring formed of former guerrilleros and soldiers. And then finally he's captured by the US and given a second chance to work as an undercover agent for the DEA.
Yeah, everything comes to the beginning.
That's a pretty powerful indictment of the happy story of democratization, isn't it?
Yeah.
That so many nations were embracing in the 90s, Chile and Argentina and now Colombia, this the story of a kind of a tragic circularity. So is all power in the final instance kind of criminality by other means or pure force that just changes its masks?
There are two layers in that book. One is that you mentioned about how violence was recycled, right? Mm-hmm. So it's how do you recycle violence? And that's very easy to understand, and that's what we have in Central America right now. I mean, a violence that has been recycled. Why? Mm. Because the state, the institutions, the society doesn't have the tools to deal with people that were involved in the conflicts, and then the violence that they learned to do, becomes their only tool to survive, for saying something.
That's the only survival, job, isn't it?
About surviving.
Yeah.
And so that's there. But there are other layers. The other one is that, for me, you were talking at the beginning of this conversation about my critique of testimony. This is the book, Testimony.
Yeah.
Because testimony is telling the truth, right, of good people. How good I was, how bad my enemies are, how bad they treated me, how good I did, how truthful I am, how much truth is on me, and believe me. And so, but this guy is the bad guy.
And
he's not trying to convince you of anything,
nothing,
right?
Because,
but he's not too aware of anything either, because he doesn't have emotions. Because he's a killing machine, right? So this is the other layer, and the other layer is language, because to create that character for me was a kind of tour de force, in the sense that could have nothing that belonged to my own world, you know, in the way how I understand life, right? And you mentioned a word that for me is key in this survival.
Survival, right?
He's a survivor. But then I've been thinking about, and I think, well, I mean, to be Salvadorian is to be a survivor, you know?
I think all of your characters are surviving by any means.
Yeah, because
possible.
Everything around is so hostile, everything around is so, that it doesn't matter, it has to do with politics or whatever, but you survive. Mm-hmm. And your gene works to survive. And this guy, I remember when I wrote that book, I was my brother's house in Basel, and I was reading Así Habló Zaratustra, that is about the will.
And I said,
it's because will has no ideology. The will to survive or to, you know, has no ideology. And so it's about that. The book is about surviving. But also, about how you are, because you are just surviving. You are just a kind of puppet of the big powers.
Or whoever happens to hire you out for the best fee. That's interesting, because there's a Nietzschean dimension to your narration of history in Tirana Memoria, in Tyrant Memory, isn't there?
Yeah.
Where they meet, where the Pericles, Aragon, the end, meets Chelon, his friend, and they say, and this is a phrase that we hear in many of your novels, there was no return. There is no eternal return. And then he says, I think, well, if there...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There is an eternal return, that would be a really sadistic punishment. But I noticed that, just I've jumped slightly to that later novel, there's an interesting in these kind of historical patterns where, at a macro level, isn't there, where, so Robocop ends up back where he started. He's trained by the US in Panama, and he finally ends up with the DEA after fighting with these guerrilleros. And in Tirana Memoria and Tyrant Memory, we have the generations going full circle. The abuelo of Pericles, who'd led a group of indigenous men against the conservative government. His son then joins the forces of El Brujo, and then his son becomes politically radicalized during the 1944 coup in Salvador, and then aligns himself with the military afterwards. And
there's a sense of history, like...
Somehow history, there's a cycle, but somehow friends and enemies are reconciled over history. They occupy different points of a wheel that keeps turning, as you say.
Yeah, the wheel, that's the key. Image for that.
Yeah. So father and, so usually son, grandson and grandfather, but never son and father. Sorry, I digress. I liked what you said about the, going back to talk about Diablo en el Espejo, She Devil in the Mirror. There was this lovely quotation at one point, Laura Rivera, who's twittering and kind of obsessively about this crime which has been carried out by Robocop in the later novel, and she's going to get to the bottom of it, but she sort of indicts herself and her whole social class in the process. She says, in other cities, you live on one side and the bad guys live on the other, and there are miles in between, which is how it should be. But in this country, everything's all mixed together, everything's squished together, everything's uno encima del otro, no? And I wonder whether that sense of being squished, of being occupying this small space where everything's interwoven, is what this novel performs, and what many of your novels perform, the sense of being uno encima del otro, no, difícil de desentramar.
Well, I think that's part of Salvadorian culture, right? Mm. I mean, you have one of the highest density of population in the Western Hemisphere, right? Mm. You have more than, I don't know, maybe almost 300 people by a square kilometer. So that means that there are a lot of people. Everywhere you go, there are people, right? I mean, you think that you're in the mountains. You are not in the mountains. There are people and garbage. And you see,
yeah,
right? And so, and I think that that's very important in the sense how you conform your mind and your values and your way of understanding life. So, but that novel, what the novel does in a way is try to portray this ruling class that was so frivolous, so and so criminal in a way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They were not doing any killing in the sense that they had the army to do that, but they were what's inside them.
They were in bed
yeah.
with the people doing the killing
yeah.
and swapping lovers.
That's a monologue. For me, it was the first time that I did a long monologue in a voice of a woman, and a woman that is not a nice lady. It's a lady that could be a little bit repulsive. But the funny thing is that many people keep reading.
Mm-hmm.
Keep reading because her voice is very powerful.
It's very, very seductive and compelling.
Yeah. 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 Once I met this girl in a bar in San Salvador, and she said, "You based on me for writing that character." And I said, "No."
No, no, no. She did protest a little too much. I'm aware that we've gone slightly over our 45 minutes, so maybe I should ask a few more general questions so as to give everyone here the chance to ask questions. So one question I haven't asked you is, and this is a much more personal one, is how do you write? And I suppose that's prompted by your use of these free-flowing monologues. Do you start with a plan in your head, or do you allow the writing to take you to different places? Is it a discovery?
Each book has its own story about that. I mean, and the more I plan, the more I change the plans. And there is a kind of trend, let's say, that short novels like Revulsion, Elasco, like Dance with the Snakes, like Senselessness, that are novels based on how do you say that? There is a word that doesn't come to, but it's like when you have a car and it's just boom.
A kind of inertia, the impact.
In the impact, but there's another word.
Acceleration. Acceleration.
Yeah, but it's like spring. It's like when you run 200 meters or 100 meters. You don't have time to do any kind of a speculation, right? You just run.
Yep.
Right? You run. You don't have time to say between the 50 and the 60 meters, I'm going just to go a little bit low, and then in the 60, I will go. No.
Yeah.
You run.
You run.
Right?
Yep.
The whole time, full.
Mm-hmm.
But if you run 400 meters, maybe it's not like that.
Uh-huh.
And if you run 800 meters, it's not like that. And if you run a marathon, it's completely different. So books are like that in a way for me.
Mm.
So books that are just 100 or 200 meters are like, there is almost no plan, just two pages with some notes, right? But Thailand Memory took me like a life, right? I don't know.
It's a very, very different novel. It's very ambitious in its historical sweep, isn't it? I mean, it's a novel that thinks about history. It brings together two very different experiences of history.
And besides that, there are these, afterwards I understood that there are like two blocks of novels, right? Because there are these novels like El Arma en el Hombre, The Devil in the Mirror, or Senselessness, Revulsion, that are novels that were written between the late 1890s and the beginning of this century. But then there are the other group of novels, Tyrant Memory or The Dream of My Return, that belong to a family saga, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's makes a little difference in the sense that there are some characters that come from the saga that suddenly I say, this character must be developed, must be, I have to work with him, right, or with her. And so it's like another kind of experience.
I know you have, I mean, there's the family saga of the Aragones.
Yeah.
But I also felt that in some of the shorter novels, there was a constellation of a kind of growing family saga, which was also a national saga, because you take characters from one novel, you then tell that story. There's
Yeah, it's not a concept of saga.
Okay.
It's like a group of novels, right, that are related with and different period of history, the 40s that was the dictatorships and the fighting against the dictatorship, the 70s or the 60s that was the war between El Salvador and Honduras that was very important because most of the problems that the civil war in El Salvador in a way came from that situation because all the Salvadorians that returned to from Honduras, and that's in Desmoronamiento, another novel that is about the family. Mm-hmm. And then I have in this Tyrant Memory has the 70s, and then the beginning of the war that is La Sirvienta y el Luchador, right? The month where Monseñor Romero, Bishop Romero was killed, right? Yeah. And then afterwards you have the 90s, the post-war. So that's why when this aspect about cynicism of the post-war is just like this.
It's a tiny fragment. Because I think there are moments of great humanity in Tyrant Memory, and there are moments of great comedy. Yeah? And then you've got this very tragic vision at the end. Where we see another instance of these reversals and inversion of family allegiances. I was thinking of Karl Marx, actually, when Hegel says somewhere that history repeats itself. He forgot to say first time is tragedy, second time is farce. And there's a sense of a kind of tragi-comedy in that, those repetitions, those cycles as well.
Yeah. We are just going around and around, like the dog that tries to bite its own.
But it's less mordant, less bitter, I find. Aide is a very human character. We feel for her. I mean, she's the beginning of the culture of the madres who come out and collect and organize together to overthrow the regime long before what we see in Argentina or in Chile.
Yeah, that novel is the novel in which I have more common sense characters. I mean, more normal.
They're not mad.
Yeah, not very crazy, delirant that are in the other ones.
They don't drink very much.
They don't, and they are, Aide is Catholic, Aide is a very family lady, and Aide is very traditional. And so for me it was like experience to go into other kind of war in that sense.
Perhaps we should open up the floor to questions. Just before we do so, if anyone objects to what Horacio is writing, I have words from Bolaño. He says, Moya's humor threatens the hormonal stability of imbeciles, who when they read him, feel the irrepressible desire to hang the author in the town square. I can't think of a higher honor for a real writer. And I'd like to echo this.
So over
to the public.
Thank you, Wallace. First of all, thank you both. Thank you, Rory, and thank you for being here. It's an honor to hear you talking. You mentioned the very briefly in passing the assassination of Bishop Romero. And I just wondered if you thought, if you had any perspective on the reception of Jorge Galán's Noviembre, which came out last year, and how that positions reading and literature in El Salvador today.
That's the second book on the killing of Romero. The first one was a play written in Costa Rica, but in the 80s, that was much more close to the death of the Archbishop of T.S. Eliot than this. This is a non-fiction book, and it's a very interesting book in the sense that goes into the personal things of the priests on that period in how they were killed. I don't think that the book gives any information that was not already public, right? So it's a little bit difficult to understand. Maybe he was, as far as I understand, he was threatened because what the information that he has and has not been published, because he was obliged by a Spanish judge to give all his tapes. And so maybe that is something that affected the some military that were very open to talk, and then he didn't put that information in the book because the book has nothing to explain why the reaction has been so extreme, right? And there is another book about Monsignor Romero that was published a couple of months ago by an academic in, a scholar in the U.S. that is part of the group that works on the judicial system in the U.S. to take into trial all this military, right? And that has information that you say. So I think that the in the literary way is good, the book is very positive because reminds to young Salvadorian writers that we have a kind of history where if we had kind of Shakespeare, we had all the tragedies there. You know what I mean? We have Roque Dalton, we have Monsignor Romero, we have the Jesuits, we have the because Galán is not Monsignor Romero, it's about the Jesuits, and we have the killing of Marcial, that was a commandant, that was a killing that is just a tragedy, you know? Yeah. Salvador is full of tragedies, right? And this, but very, very, very concentrate material for writers of tragedies. So I think it's, in that sense, it's very positive and it, because there are plenty of material in our country to talk about real history.
Hello. Can you comment or reflect on your life experience during the war in El Salvador? What I'm trying to get is what made you write what you have written. You know, what is your experience? How long do you live there? What violent experiences do you have? What is your...
Yeah. Let's say that I was out of El Salvador during the whole civil war. So that's why I don't write about the civil war. There are no novels about the civil war in itself, about the war, the combats, the... something that, let's say, some equivalent of war books about with characters that are fighting, that are in the middle of the war, because I didn't have that experience. So for me, it's quite difficult to go into that. But the 10 years of the Civil War, I was most of the time in Mexico City. And of course, a Civil War is it's like a kind of maelstrom, right? That everyone was in a way involved in that, right? In my case, as a journalist, most of the time, half of my stay in Mexico was working as a journalist, tracking what was happening in El Salvador, working for agencies that were deeply involved covering the situation of the war, right? But everything came to me indirectly, in the sense that experiences that I had was until the 80s. Let's say my novel, my before the last, La Sirvienta y el Luchador, that is not in English, it's only in French. La Sirvienta y el Luchador takes place in February, March 1980, like 2 weeks before Bishop Romero was killed. And that was the last time I was in El Salvador. And I wanted to write a book about that because that was my most intense experience of terror. Since then, I never had that kind of experience of terror. Terror when you go out and you go to the bus stop and you feel that the atmosphere, the air is so dense that you can even cut it and you see everyone and all your senses are like in a different dimension, expecting the shooting, the bombing, or the kidnapping, and it's like, it's a horrible situation. And I left after that, like a couple of months later, I left in the day that the state of siege was ordered. That was March 6, I guess. But Then I came back in the 1988. The Civil War was still happening, but that was different. I came as a journalist and doing things. But that the Civil War took our youth, right? Directly or indirectly. Because all our energies, even if we were not inside the country, were around that. And I think that was unavoidable.
And I've noticed in a couple of your books, or at least in one, which I guess is Tirana Memoria, that you make an effort in presenting the point of view of the middle class, which personally I feel is the least interesting point of view of whatever happened in El Salvador. So I want to understand why. I think there's an, I don't remember if I read it in another one, but definitely that one, you know, it's very prominent, the woman that...
Yeah. In that book, in Tyrant Memory, the point of view of some of the military are key for the book, because this book takes place during the coup d'etat and then the general strike against the General Martinez, Hernandez Martinez dictatorship. And the coup d'etat was pushed by a group of young officers of the Salvadorian army that were trained in the U.S. By the end of the Second World War and were more closer to Roosevelt ideas and whatever. And then they were defeated, and some of them were shot, were executed, but because they were defeated. And then came the general strike, and the general strike obliged the force, the dictator, to leave the country. And so for me, that period was important in the sense that it was the only moment in Salvadorian history when the old sectors, because the rich Salvadorians were against Martinez, you know, and even the Americans, and so that everybody was against the dictator, and was the last dictator in El Salvador, of course. And so without putting their points of view, the novel didn't have any... When I started that novel, I was thinking of writing the novel from her husband's point of view, that was in jail. But her husband had been the private secretary of the dictator, then had been ambassador in Brussels, and then had become a Soviet spy in the U.S. And a spy doesn't write a novel or doesn't tell his secrets. So that's why I spent like 3 months trying to write and to get his voice. And I said,
he doesn't write.
There is no way that this guy is going to give me his voice because he's a spy. So,
unless he's under hypnosis.
Yeah, and then I said I will tell the story from the point of view of his wife, and that's how I ended up writing.
But it's history told not by the main protagonist. That's the beauty of that story. Yeah. It's the history told by
someone that doesn't have a political consciousness.
Every day,
right?
The mothers, the students who don't know what their ideological affiliations are. And the fisherman who takes them to the island, who doesn't know what the hell they're doing.
We all had a very strong political view and participation in a sense. So there were not real bystanders. You know, you cannot have a real witness outside the story in that period in El Salvador, I think.
Would you say a little more about your relationship with Thomas Bernhard?
Well, that's something that happened many years ago. I think that I have some facility to imitate. It happened to me when I was a young poet that I started to write as Cesar Vallejo. That's why I left poetry. And
you can't get much better, can you?
No, you need to suffer a lot to write that poetry. Yeah. And then I was in Mexico, and I had these Guatemalan friends. The book is dedicated to him. And he used to steal these books from Gandhi bookstore and gave the book to me, right? You have to read this. You have to read this. And so and I started to read this guy, and I really enjoy his...
Was this Ulises Lima?
No.
He stole books from the Gandhi, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's Bolaños. Yeah. Stuff. And then, of course, I was impressed. I was impressed because his prose, I read it in Spanish, but we were talking about Don Miguel Sáenz translations that are so good. And I know Miguel Sáenz, and he never met Berhard, because Berhard was a very difficult guy. Right, even his Spanish translator, that was the first translations were made in Spain, before France, before the U.S. And two times Don Miguel Sáenz went to look for Berhard to the hotels where the appointment was, and he had already left. Right, so he was a difficult guy, of course. And I was impressed by his prose, of course, by his rhythm, by his sense of music in the prose, because I think that the principle of the fugue is the base of that prose, right? So, someone that has studied music can get that idea of how the repetition becomes in a different motif and how you are moving from motif to motif. And then at the same time, the poison.
Yeah.
Right. So you have this music here and the poison here, right? So for me, Berhard is like the cascabel. You know, it's the music, and then the bite, right, that kills you. I like that. So I read him with that passion, interest, and then I, of course, got intoxicated.
Yeah.
And because I got intoxicated, I wrote that book that you were talking about.
So it was a purge.
Yeah, I said I have to get rid of this guy, right? Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And I wrote that book, and I have never read him again since then.
Don Horacio, yo soy del Salvador. Mucho gusto,
mucho placer.
I've been here in London for about 10 years now, and I had an opportunity a few months ago to write something for a publication in El Salvador. I showed it to a couple of people in El Salvador, and they kind of made me feel like I was a little bit out of touch because I was not living in El Salvador, and some of what I was writing was about El Salvador. Do you ever feel that way, a little bit out of touch, a little bit like perhaps you feel like you shouldn't write about El Salvador because you don't live there?
Oh, I am completely out of touch, but on the contrary, that's why I write. You know, because what I write is based on the memories that I have of that, on the impressions and how that country wounded me, how that country affected me. And so I have still enough material to write. I'm not writing about contemporarity in El Salvador. I'm not too much interested in what is happening right now in El Salvador, because it's not my interest right now. And so, of course, if I go there, I feel like an alien, like if I have come from, but I'm not writing about that. I'm writing about 30 years ago, 25 years ago. Journalists are writing about what is happening. And I read that, and I read what is happening with the gangs and what is happening with the political situation and what is happening, all the problems that the country has, and I could say I won't write about that, you know, because it's not my task. There will be young writers that have been wounded by the situation that they are facing right now there, and they will do it better. You know, I don't write by references. I don't write thinking, oh, this is a great topic. You know, I will go into the gangs because that's a topic. Mm-hmm. I don't write books like that. A book has to be here. Mm. And that has to be, in a way, related with some kind of experience that I have, something that has wounded me, that has affected me, something that has created an energy in me. And so that's why I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about other things that is important in your question for me as a writer. Because if you are someone that is into social sciences or someone that is into contemporary studies, of course you have to be very close, right? But fiction doesn't work that way. I could write a novel about the revolution against General Meléndez in El Salvador in 1990, and that will be a novel, right? And I don't need to be there if I have something that pushed me to do it. But there is the problem of language. And that's a problem that a writer has when a writer lives in a country where he doesn't deal daily with his own language, right? Or deals in a very flat and standard way. And so in that sense, there are concerns because language is alive and changes like this, right? And a writer, of course, a writer is not an anthropologist that has to have a track of all the changes in the book. That's not, but language is not only the words, it's what it, those words express and the feeling of the people there and that stuff. So sometimes I feel far of the language, you know, in that sense of the Salvadorian way of expressing things. And then I have to face situations in which I am tempted to use a kind of expression, but I have to think a lot, is that was the expression of the time of this character, right? Because now I don't know how people say that, you know, in the sense of, and of course we are privileged because we have a language that is spoken by so many people and we are so all around. But this kind of problem for a writer coming from a country like, let's say, Poland, right, or small countries where not too many millions people talk the language, they face the best reflection on these were made by Milosz, the Polish poet, and he was in California, completely isolated from language, Polish language, and he said, I don't want to write in English, he said, right?
Or Gombrowicz.
Gombrowicz, and he didn't want to write it, and he didn't do it. He didn't write in Spanish. And so, but for us, I mean, I just can go to Washington or to L.A., and I have to escape from Salvadorians, right?
Yeah. Remember that Shakespeare wrote this great novel called Hamlet? He'd never been to Denmark. There's a question.
The last, time. I guess, right?
How are we for time? One last question.
All right. It's a bit of a follow-up question as well, I guess. You've talked about how not being in El Salvador's shaped how you write. What about talking about the places you have been and how it's affected? Uh-huh. I guess I'm particularly interested in Mexico and Mexico City, which you've alluded to, which strikes me as a particularly having its own particular literary sort of ecosystem, which is very, you know, full of writers and full of exiles from all over Latin America. So could you talk a bit about that, how that has also shaped your writing?
At least three or four of my novels take place in Mexico City, right? So until now, the books that have been published, let's say that the geographical region goes from Costa Rica to Mexico, right? And so the characters move around those countries, and the novels take place, some of them part in El Salvador, part in Mexico, some of them part in Honduras, part in El Salvador, some of them part in Costa Rica, part in Mexico. But that has been my region, in a sense, right? But I have not been living there for the last, let's say, 12, 13 years. That has started to affect me in a way that I am thinking much more about other kind of diasporas, right? I'm not going to write a novel about Americans, or I'm not going to write a novel that I spent 2 years in Germany about Germans as German, right? And I think that in this sense, I have mentioned this before, that there are two kind of writers. This is schematic, but works. I mean, there is the writer from the metropolitan powers, from the empires, that they go to different places and they write on those places. Or Graham Greene, or Paul Bowles, or you know, writers that they move and they have the setting in those countries, right? But then you have the writers from the dominated periphery countries, like Joyce in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So that was a periphery. That was a kind of colony. And then it doesn't matter if he was in Zurich or if he was in Paris, he just couldn't stop writing about Dublin, right? And so, and I think that in a way, for me, has been like that. It doesn't matter where I have been. I've been moving in that region that is called like Mesoamerica, right? That is from Mexico to Costa Rica. Mm. But I don't know what comes next.
Life in the middle.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to draw to a close now. So I think we should give Horacio a great round of applause. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.